maybe fuss over here occasionally during the event. No, no, it's fine. I'm just warning you if I suddenly
zoom in your face. Oh, no problem. She's not coming to sit on you.
Is one of the best directors in the country. So, you know.
Gosh.
And I want you to make use of John Rando while you have him here, because when question and answers should be for both of us.
David and I, you know, I've directed, I think, close to 16 different plays and musicals of David's. Maybe more. I've lost count because there's so many short plays that we did together and some on the air. But we started work together 1996, we think. And I have to say, the best thing about working with David is just having a great friend. So in the theater, it's complicated. And to have somebody like David to just trust is a really great thing for a director. So anyway, that said, I'm gonna open because I have a few questions to give to David, and then we could to start our conversation. So I'm gonna name some plays here that you've written, sir, and they're gonna have a kind of unifying theme going on with them: Flea in Her Ear, The Liar, School for Lies, Metro Maniacs, The Heir Apparent, Venus and Fur. So these are these adaptations, or are they translations? Or you have a phrase that you like to use that I would love for you to talk to us about.
Translation. Yes, that's what I would say. These things that I've been doing are not quite translations and not quite adaptations, so I call them translactations, because I give myself the liberty to do whatever the hell I want. All of these authors are dead, which is in my favor, because they can't sue me or complain, and I don't have to give them any royalties. But I should think that if Shakespeare were alive today and you asked him what he did, he would probably say translatation, because of his 37, more or less, plays, 35 are adaptations of other people's work. And that may be why he didn't care if they were printed or not at the end of his life. I just think that he collected his money and wanted to go home and didn't care. But part of the reason that happened is chance, because the Chicago Shakespeare Theater years ago asked me to adapt A Flea in Her Ear, and I did, and I really enjoyed it, partly for the reason that I didn't have to work out the plot. I am terrible at story, and because, you know, on stage, because play is made of very few words, really, and is a very simple plot. If somebody says yes, it is an action, and so it has repercussions. And so, in my mind, I'm constantly looking to see what the possible repercussions are, because you don't want to go down a wrong avenue. And so I am saved that problem by Mark Twain writing Is He Dead? Or what's his name writing Venus and Fur? Sacher Masoch. I couldn't remember it. So lately, a lot of my work has been, of one kind or another, by way of somebody else. One of the things that I can talk about in more detail later are these, I've been doing these adaptations, translocations of French classical comedy, like The Heir Apparent and The Metro Maniacs and The Liar, and that's all. That has entered into the realm of verse, which is yet another avenue. But it takes the burden off of me, because basically what I do is I take something and I see what, for example, what Molière would have done had he lived another 366 years, and how he would have fixed Tartuffe. You know, so I feel that I'm just doing the job that Molière would have done in my own voice. And so the other thing that has contributed to that is, I don't know if you know the Encores series of musicals at City Center, but I did 33 of those. John directed maybe 8 of those, something like that. And that was the world's best graduate course in playwriting, because basically, it's a form of literary ventriloquism where you take a musical from 1933 that was written by George and Ira Gershwin and Mosshart, and you have to cut it down to 2/3 of its size, write new material, sometimes add in songs that were cut. And what that means is you have to think the way Mozart, Ira Gershwin, and George Gershwin were thinking in 1933. And so that kind of led the way to these transplantations in a certain way.
You mentioned French classical comedy, which you did a lot of them. Do you speak French? Do you read French? I mean, how do you actually do it?
I'm sorry you asked me that question. Here's how the French thing happened. The Chicago Shakespeare Theater asked me to do a flea in her ear in about 2000 or something. They were looking for a new translation of Feydeau's farce. And I did not want to do what playwrights most often do now, which is go to the drama bookshop, buy all the available translations, shuffle them together, and come up with a version. I wanted to take Feydeau's play and work from the original. And my knowledge of French was based on a year and a half of French at Northwestern with a very beautiful French teacher and a girlfriend who lived in Paris whom I visited for 3 weeks. That was sort of where I was with French. And so, I got a grammar book, and I sort of went through the grammar book fast, and I took Feydeau and I started reading him. And the nice thing about starting on Feydeau is that farce is fundamentally a machine. You know, if there is anything extraneous in a farce, it shouldn't be there. And so it's very stripped down. And so my task in that was A, to relearn French, B, to take this play and figure out what the diction would be now. How do these people speak? Do they speak like 1910 or do they speak like now? What age is this taking place in? So you have these questions. And so, but once I did that, and it was very successful at Chicago, I somehow got this reputation as a French translator. I should tell you, there was one place in A Flea in Her Ear when I was working on it, and I came to this place in the French where there was clearly meant to be a joke. Feydeau had, you know that rhythm of it's, you know, it's speeding up, and you know that there's a punchline coming. But I could not figure out what the punchline meant. So there was this French guy who lived across the hall from us. So I went across and I knocked on his door and I said, would you look at this and tell me what that means? And he said, I have no idea. And so that really gave me license to do whatever I wanted. And so I suddenly had this reputation as a French translator without having deserved it. And a classic stage company came to me with a Yasmina Reza play. She wrote Art. They brought me a Yasmina Reza play to translate, and I said, why not? So I did that. And unfortunately, or fortunately, Yasmina Reza is alive. And so I had to be very, very faithful to what I was doing. But I sort of had the French bug, even though, truth to tell, my German is much, much better than my French. And I would love to translate German plays, but German comedy is an oxymoron in any language of the world. And you may sift German literature until you are blue in the face and you will not find comedy. So I am stuck with the funny French. Anyway, so...
Wait. Yeah. The funny French, I love it. But see, you do Feydeau, which is this basically, dialogue.
And which John directed, by the way, brilliantly. In
But then there's Corneille, and there's Regnard. There's these other playwrights that don't write in prose, but write in verse, and then write in iambic pentameter, and sometimes even ridiculous pentameter.
Hexameter.
Yeah. So how does that happen? How do you do that?
Every good thing that's ever happened to me in life has happened by accident. You know, I have found, this is my wisdom speaking, I have found that anything I've ever wanted, I've never gotten, that all the great things of my life have come to me. And it was so with Flea in Her Ear, it was so with Yasmina Reza, and it was so with French 18th century comedy, because what happened was, I now was firmly fixed as a French translator. I had done Yasmina Reza and Feydeau, and I got, my agent called me up and said, Michael Kahn of the Shakespeare Theater of Washington wants to know if you would like to adapt The Liar, which is by Corneille, which is a play I'd never heard of. And I said, sure, you know, send it over. I also asked everybody I knew, and nobody knew about this play. So they sent it to me in French because I was a French translator. And so there's this play in from 1643 that I'd never heard of by you know, the great tragedian Pierre Corneille, and it was wonderful. It was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever read, and I couldn't believe it was in French. You know, it was like, it was as if somebody had sent me A Midsummer Night's Dream, except it was in French, and nobody knew about it. And so I instantly said to Michael Kahn, yes, I want to do this. The thing is that opened up this whole other world, because French classical comedy, like French drama, until almost the middle of the 19th century, was in verse. And it was in rhymed couplets of 12 syllables a line, with a caesura in the middle of each line. And so the question I was faced with was, how do you do this? You know, I could take that play and turn it into prose, because it's a wonderful situation. If I did that, it would turn into a Seinfeld episode, you know, which is to say, nothing. It would turn into this flimsy little sitcom. And so I knew, but let me tell you what The Liar is about. The Liar is about this pathological young man. This young man arrives in Paris, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and he's a pathological liar. And no matter what you ask him about, he lies. And so he meets a young woman, and he thinks her name is Clarice, but her name is Lucrece. That's the whole plot. And what Corneille does in spinning this, because he keeps telling lies, what Corneille does in spinning this is create this world in which just about anything can happen because of this young man with these flights of incredible imagination and these page-long lies that he tells. So naturally, I thought, this has to be in poetry because this is the story of an artist. It's basically a metaphor for someone who is out there on the high wire of language and not falling. And so knowing that, how do you do it? Do you do it in couplets, which are the death of you know, famous death of drama everywhere? So I decided, yes, I have to do it in couplets in iambic pentameter. And I would have to figure out, A, how to write in iambic pentameter, and B, how to make it funny. And so I've said this before and I'll say it again, I've never had more fun than I had working on The Liar, because I spent 3 months reading it every day, taking notes on how I would change the plot, because I knew the plot was going to need some supporting, and at the same time, every morning, I read Shakespeare's sonnets out loud to myself to hear iambic pentameter and see how he did it and how he made iambic pentameter work. Then I started reading from the comedies like As You Like It and Twelfth Night to see how he infused energy into iambic pentameter. The nice thing about iambic pentameter, and the reason why it is why it was used for century after century, is that iambic pentameter is natural energy. It is like these quanta of thought and feeling coming at you in 10-syllable bursts. And it does a lot of your thinking and feeling for you, because it is telling you at what rhythm you can feel and when you slow down and when you stop. And so I realized I had been given this magical toolbox. I was this child in a new toy shop with iambic pentameter. So every day I would take my daily walk after doing my work, and I would turn everything I saw into my anger content. I would change lingerie ads on the sides of buses, and you know, I would see a sentence running on the ticker tape of the news and try to think, how does that shorten to 10 syllables? Because I'll tell you what's good about 10 syllables. In 10 syllables, slightly contracts everything. It contracts feeling, it contracts thought, so that it concentrates. And when you give that to an audience, they have to listen a little more closely, and the actors have to lean in a little more closely themselves. And so there is this greater interesting tension between the actors and the audience, because both are leaning in a little further. And so I fell in love with it. And so I've done four of those. One of them is coming in the spring to the Red Bull, called The Metromaniacs, a play that nobody has ever heard of or, you know, hasn't been translated. I will tell you this about the author of The Metromaniacs. The author of The Metromaniacs was kept out of the French Academy in 1738, because he wrote an ode to the penis. And the king would not allow him to be put into the French Academy, so think about it. Yeah. Come see the play, it's not terrible.
Okay, I'm gonna switch subjects a little bit. Okay, I'm gonna name some places, some theaters. You've started to name them. I'm gonna name four places. And then I just want you to talk about a writer's relationship to theaters. The Shakespeare Theater in D.C., Classic Stage Company here in New York, Primary Stages, and begin with Manhattan Punchline.
Wow, that's a nice list of theaters. That's a whole evening. That question is
a whole evening's
worth. Wow.
What is it about those places and you? How did it happen? Why did it happen?
Those theaters fundamentally sum up my life as a playwright in a funny way. I was a late bloomer, I suppose you could say, because All in the Timing happened. All in the Timing was the play that sort of put me on the roles of people. But that happened in 1992, and I've been writing for a long time. All in the Timing was a group of one-act plays, almost all of which had been done in New York. And here's what happened. I went to Yale Drama School. I got out of Yale Drama School. I spent some years. And I made the Woody Allen mistake. The Woody Allen mistake is that you have to be serious to be serious. And I was writing these intensely serious plays, you know. I was putting Strindberg to shame. He looked like Mel Brooks these plays I was writing. And so then I was in my 30s, and what happened was, it's very simple, and this is key to the life of artists. I got a job writing a movie, and for the first time in my whole writing life, I actually could pay my rent without having to temp type, work in a bookstore, wait, whatever you want. And so I suddenly had some money in the bank, and one night I sat down and I wrote this little play called Words, 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 about the three monkeys who are trying to write Hamlet and what they talk about while they're doing it. And I wrote it all in one night, and I sent it to this place called the Manhattan Punchline Theater, which had an annual one-act comedy festival. And they picked it up. And so I suddenly was writing comedy. I did, you know, it had sort of, as I say, come to me out of the blue. And so every year after that, I would write a comedy or two for the Manhattan Punchline Theater, just a little one act. And I remember one of them. I wrote a play called Philip Glass Buys a Loaf of Bread, which is 5 minutes and 38 seconds long and is spoken in rhythm by four actors in sort of Robert Wilson style, you know. It's kind of a parody of Ernst Fenman Beach, which John has directed brilliantly, the best version ever. Anyway, so I wrote this play, tapping it out on my tabletop late at night, you know, in rhythm for four actors. And I was going to submit it to the Manhattan Punchline. And I thought, they are never going to take this one, you know. And so I walk into Steve Kaplan, who was the head of Manhattan Punchline, and I said, Steve, I've got a new comedy I want to submit. And he looked at it and he said, fill a glass, buy a loaf of bread, I'll do it. And so that was how that one got in. But the great thing about Manhattan Punchline, and I have to squeeze all these in. The great thing about Manhattan Punchline, it was true theater. They had a budget that was in double digits, and they had a fax machine. That was it. And they gave you a stage and no money. And the thing is, when you have that, you have to be good. You know, it's like if you want to attract attention, if you want to keep your audience, you have no excuse. You can't blame the set or the costume. You have to actually be good. And so that is the best training in the world. And every year I put these up. All in the timing finally happened and went to primary stages in their 99-seat theater. It was turned down by every theater in New York except primary stages. Because they said an evening of one-act plays will never sell. And it ran for 2 years at the John Houseman, moving from its 99-seat theater. What would be next in that list?
You now shift to, well, I just want to say that just to underscore, New York off-Broadway, early 90s.
Off?
Yeah, an incredible time for the theater. A very different world than what we live in right now, isn't it? Classic stage.
Classic stage, oh my God. I hope all of you are subscribers of Classic Stage. I've done six plays in 10 years there, I think. I did New Jerusalem, which was about Spinoza. I did Venus and Fur. I did The Liar. School for Lies, Heir Apparent. I forget what else. The thing about Classic Stage is, as John said, the 90s and off Broadway and those little 99-seat theaters are almost all gone now because nobody can afford to have them. Classic Stage is a remnant of another age, which is off Broadway. It's 200 seats that can change to any shape. It has the best acoustics in the world. It's an old stable and it's four stories high above the lighting room. And so if you do the classics there, if you do Shakespeare, if you do French classical comedy, the sound is so warm and it's all natural sound. And so I love, you're also so present because it's about, you know, it's about as big as this room, and so the actors are right there. And I don't know if some of you may have seen Venus and Fur down there, but the design for Venus and Fur, which was by the brilliant John Lee Beatty, was so extraordinary and used that space. And here's what he did. He put it three-quarters around, with the audience three-quarters around this thrust stage. But when you walked in into the theater, and you can't get out of Classic Stage once you're in it, you know, you are in the room. When you walked in, there was this three-story high box of silk. And there was no music. There was just this curtain hanging very high up. And you had no idea what was behind it. And the lights go down, there's a thunderclap, and the entire three floors of silk curtain drop to the floor, and suddenly there's this man there on a cell phone. And the immediacy of that was so electric that when it moved to Broadway, I thought that half of the play had gone away just because of the power of the opening was gone. And also the power of being in a room that you can't get out of, where two people are involved in an erotic game. And that play was so sexy there, I cannot tell you. There was a scene, we also got some interesting audiences, needless to say. There was a scene, for those of you who saw it, where the man, it's a man and a woman, and the woman says to the man, change my shoes. Change my shoes. And that in the stage direction that I wrote, it said he changes her shoes. Walter Bobby, who directed that play brilliantly, said to me, "Oh no, no, this is going to be a moment." And so he didn't just change her shoes. Walter Bobby got the most amazing pair of dominatrix boots you've ever seen, and he had the man kneel at her feet and change her into those boots. And he told the actor, "Take as long as you want." And so this was a silent scene, 5 minutes long, in which he changed this woman into boots. And there was a night when they were doing it, sort of where I am now, and a man walked up the center aisle and stood right there and watched them do it. And then he disappeared back into the crowd. There was the night that four guys dressed like Wall Street came and sat in the top row at the back. And the stage manager's report said, "Four young men arrived in the audience tonight, and when the lights went down, they broke up brandy snifters and a bottle of brandy and drank for the entire play." There was the woman who sat where you're sitting, and every time the woman in the play would sort of make a point, this woman would go, "Yes!" So it was interesting down there. And that is theater. That is real theater. And so, part of it is the makeup of the room. You are not sitting, 100 feet back. You're not in a balcony. You are there. And those actors are so present. And so that's part of what I love about classic stage.
Yeah, and then, I'm going to change my next question. We have one more theater to talk about, but the truth is that it's going to include this. I'm going to name two other places in this country that are important to you. And I want you to talk about them in reflection of your work, how they inspired you, how they made you who you are, and how they made you write what you write. One place is your hometown, Chicago. And that includes the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. And the other place is San Francisco, and the city that you spent some time in. And write about all these other worlds, and then you write about French worlds, but these two places are very important to you. And I'm just curious,
That's another whole evening. That's a book.
Yes, it is, I know. San Francisco, start there.
San Francisco. I had one of the worst experiences of my life in San Francisco. theatrical experiences, I should say. I went there for a play called The Red Address, and found that I had a director who was doing speedballs at night. And so his mind was not exactly on the play. That was my baptism of fire in San Francisco. San Francisco is hard because it's a whole, it's like, here's what I'll say about San Francisco. I have often found that the obvious is staring you in the face. No, the obvious is staring me in the face, and I don't see it. And I moved to San Francisco, and it's like the airplane door closed as I was moving there, and I thought, "Oh, I see, I'm having a midlife crisis." But the airplane door had closed. And so that was sort of San Francisco, besides directors on speedballs, and San Francisco, which is beautiful and empty. And so I have this, I always wanted to write a play about it, and I will sometime. Chicago is where I came from. I came from the Polish Catholic steel mill part of Chicago. The apartment I grew up in, if you ever watched The Honeymooners, my apartment looked just like that. And my dad was Ralph Cramden, the Polish version of The Honeymooners. And so that's where I came from. Needless to say, I'm a bit of a black sheep, because nobody in that neighborhood could even spell theater, much less go to it. But I went to Catholic schools in Chicago, and the theater is littered with Catholic Catholics. I don't know if you know that. But think about it. You go to a certain place and you're quiet while people perform something, which is somehow sacred in a very bizarre way. And they say words which work upon you magically. And you come out somehow feeling better or not, or feeling purged, or feeling you've been through something. And so all of that, and also having priests who taught me English literature and how to write and how to read, because I was sort of the last end, I guess. I don't know if John would be part of this, but I was sort of the last end of humanistic education, you know, where you had a set curriculum, there was a canon of things you were supposed to know about, and the priests in my school had authority because we trusted them and we believed that they wanted the best for us. And they were very hard on us, and we loved them for it because they made us be better. You know, there's a line of Wendell Berry, the great American essayist, poet, farmer, you know, speaker, whatever. But Wendell Berry said something that I always think about the theater. He said, "It is not from ourselves that we will learn to be better than we are." And I think I've always thought that's part of the job of the theater, is that you go to the theater to watch other human beings go through something, and presumably through these other people, through those actors, and all the people who worked on that, you will become somehow better than you are. And that may mean that you understand people better, that may mean that you appreciate language better. But somehow, we need other people, and that is the great socializing job of the theater. You know, I am firmly of the belief that if I hadn't gone into the theater, I would be living in a log cabin in Minnesota surrounded by guns and, you know, Nazi memorabilia or something, because the theater saved me. I was going to be a medievalist when I went into college, and somehow I ended up becoming a playwright. But the thing about the theater is that, forgive me if you've heard me say this before, but the theater and democracy came into the world at the same time in the same place. Athens, 500 BC, those two things happened, and I've always thought that can't be an accident, because they're the same thing. Both of them involve people getting together and putting aside their differences to try to make something good. And when you come into a production, when you walk into a room and you meet a director you don't know, you meet actors you don't know, you are putting everything aside and you are saying, let's concentrate on this and make it good. And everybody in the room is valuable. That's partly what's so great about the theater. That's why, if the government were smart, they would fund theater programs for every high school in the country, because in theater, you are valuable. It doesn't matter if you're sewing on the buttons or taking the tickets, you are necessary to this great thing you're trying to put up. And so, I can't remember how I even got to that. Through Chicago, through priests, through a feeling of value for literature, and thank God there was this. I was interested in Hamlet, as every 17-year-old was. And this priest, who was my teacher, said, "Do you want to do a scene from Hamlet? Find some guys and put it up." And he gave us the auditorium and let us put up a scene from Hamlet. And that is electric. I mean, the trust of that, you know, that he said, "Go ahead and do it. Go with what you want." And so that education, I suppose, was so intrinsic to what I do. I also remember that I went up to that same priest after class one day and I said, "Father, I've been reading The Wasteland and I have no idea what it means." And he said, "Good." He said, "Nobody knows what it means, but you know what? I bet that you found things that were interesting in there, interesting images. Maybe that's what he's trying to do. So read it again." And so what better education is there than that? You know, of just opening you up. And so that's Chicago for me. It was rich. It was a neighborhood full of rich rich, poor people.
Yeah, this is more of a comment, and then leading to maybe you talking a little bit about it. I want to talk about, we did what I consider just one great time in my career. We did a play called Mere Mortals, which was sort of a follow-up to All in the Time, a collection of six one-act plays. And we did it on Broadway, we were very successful, and I remember the producer, Jeffrey Richards, calling me back then, because we didn't have the internet, calling me on the phone and reading to me late one night the review that Peter Marks wrote about the show. And of course, it was really positive. And I remember it highlighted the language, which was such a pleasure to see, and mentioning the brilliance of it. And a kind of unbelievable dexterity and grace and cleverness. But he also stressed that you understand that it's also about entertaining. That language can be both. Mm-hmm. Can be both extremely brilliant and demanding of an audience, demanding of its intelligence, mm-hmm. but it also has to entertain. And it's sort of, I've always remembered that about your work, because it's almost true in everything that I've worked with or that I've seen, from Venus and Ferb to Words, to it's just to the stuff that kind of Mountain Cities and all, of course. There's always a brilliance behind it, but at the same time, there's, I've got to make it really good. Really funny. I've got to make it really entertaining. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I guess I'm asking you as the playwright, I'm asking you as the director, saying I'm so grateful that you think that way, because it helps. And maybe you could comment on that.
I think. Well, I should tell you that I was once. It may have been on that very play. John was directing some play of mine, and it just so happened that during the lunch hour, I wandered behind the table where, you know, the playwright sits next to the director and the stage manager. And it just so happened that during lunch, I walked behind John's script, and John's script was open, and I saw what he had marked in the margins. And basically down the right-hand side of the script, it said, better joke, better joke, better joke. And so, as an opening night gift for John for that particular play, I got an enormous rubber stamp that said, better joke, to save him the problem. But that is my way of saying, I'm with Bertolt Brecht, not, you know, communism, yes. But Bertolt Brecht once said, if a play isn't entertaining, it doesn't matter what else it is. And so that is kind of how I feel, that, you know, you have to take out anything that doesn't belong. You have to take out characters who have overstayed their welcome. But I do not have a very exalted idea about playwrights, to tell you the truth. And this is in answer to your question. Playwrights are well and good, but playwrights are servants of actors. We would not be, you know, we owe them our lives and our livelihoods. And so I find that, you know, actors and a good director are the whetstone of a play. And you walk in and they make you better. You know, you listen to a good actor read a speech three times, and if he can't make it work, it's not the actor's fault, it's your fault. And you have to rethink that speech. And so everything, the great thing about plays is in the rewriting. It's not in the writing. It's not sitting in a room and putting something down. It's getting in a room with other people who make it better because they're bringing their talent to it. And nobody has better antennae than an actor or a director like John. You know, John and I, is joyous because basically the way John directs, it, and there are, every director has his method, but John gets in a room and he infuses the room with positive energy so that everybody believes in what they're doing. And so when you do that, what needs to be skimmed away just comes naturally. It's like John and I had an evening where we cut plays out of the whole evening, and you know, and you come to that, but you come by trust. You have this relationship whereby you are thinking as one. And so I believe in plays being entertaining, but they are really this collective process. The great thing about theater, one of the fascinating things about theater, is that it's the only art form which is a living organism, which is to say, there's a Darwinian aspect to a play. It's like an amoeba which collects things, and it changes, and it changes when it begins, it changes when an audience meets it, it changes every day as you come to it, because it's reacting to you. Those actors can hear you, and the energy in the room is partly your energy. And so it is this verbal object that gets wiser as it goes along. And there is no other art form that does that. A painting is finished, you know. And so that's sort of my roundabout answer.
I just want to talk about that briefly, just as an example of what you're saying. We recently did a play, a collection of plays called Lives of the Saints at Primary Stages. And there's a play that David wrote. It was a new play that we were adding to this group about a couple, and the man is visiting his mother who's dying. And then the scene opens with the doctor over the dead body, or the body, and pronounces her dead. And he's quite upset, of course, and then the doctor leaves the room, and so does the wife, and then he hears the mother talking to him. But she's just been pronounced dead, and so the doctor comes back. The man freaks out. He's not sure if she's alive. He's heard something, and then he comes back in the room, and from there, this kind of incredible thing takes place. Anyway, what I'm trying to talk about is the process. We when David handed us, that is me and the actors, the script, we were completely knocked out by it and excited by it. And as we went to work on it, midway through a very important rehearsal, probably our third or fourth rehearsal where we're really on our feet, and David suddenly put his hand up and said, wait, I have to change this. Having heard what we were doing, and you made a completely amazing change to that moment. I know.
Do you remember? No.
Tell me.
In which the man starts to yell at the mother, unleashing on her. Yet this whole section didn't exist before we walked into rehearsal. And I have to say, the actor is a favorite of ours, Carson Elrod. Maybe some of you know him or would recognize him from some of the plays that we've done together. But your relationship to actors is truly remarkable. And the trust that you have with certain actors to develop the work is what I find kind of freeing for us, because it helps the process. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you remember, but the part of that doctor who pronounces the woman dead at the beginning, he had three lines at the beginning and two lines in the middle, and then we got Arnie Burton to play the doctor. If any of you saw the Inspector General, he was just in the Inspector General. He's one of the great comic actors in New York, and so he ended up reading the doctor, and suddenly the doctor had pages of stuff. He had a funny hat all of a sudden, you know, and so all of that changed. Arnie Burton was in a play that I wrote called Soap Opera, which is about the Maytag repairman falling in love with a washing machine. And Artie Burton had this, and there was this, the first time we did it, which is 15 years ago, Artie Burton was playing a bunch of small parts, and I thought, he's got to have something better. And so he just recently reminded me that I left the room, and everybody heard this typewriter going in the room, and I came back in with this long speech of him as a madman, whose life was ruined by a washing machine, a long beard, a former lover of the former Maytag repairman, and he gets sucked into the washing machine in the course of this. And so he just reminded me that I wrote that, you know, during rehearsal one day. But that's what it's like, you know, get in the theater, it's so much fun. There's no more fun than
that. So with that, we have questions,
yes.
Speaking of fun, I enjoy your work very much. In fact, I have no idea how much I enjoy it because I've been going on Encores for years, and I didn't necessarily associate you with Encores. Would you discuss the collaborative experience, how you pick the musicals, how you take some of the old chestnuts and make them relevant, what happens when you add music to the mix of theater?
Our first collaboration at City Center Encores, David brought me there because I was directing Mere Mortals, this is in 96, 7, whatever it was. And our first collaboration was Strike Up the Band, Gershwin, which is a fantastic, wonderful piece. But the interesting thing about that piece is it was written twice. It was written out of town, and the basic story is about a Swiss cheese factory in Switzerland, and it got changed to, when it came to Broadway, to a Swiss chocolate factory. And David called me up, and I had read the original, because that's what they do at Encores. They try to get the original orchestrations, they try to get the original scripts from, even if they were out of town, the out of town script. That's what they're interested in, kind of architectural or archaeologically excavating. And David called and said, "Rando, we gotta go with cheese. It's just funnier than chocolate."
So we went with cheese.
We went with cheese. And that process is really, David goes away and he tries to take these. And the great thing about Encores is that the basic rule is that 3 to 4 pages of dialogue, and then there must be a song, because it's essentially a concert, at least in the early days, and it still is weirdly, even though we do a lot more there than we did in the early days. And so David had that rule, and he stuck to it. And
yeah, I came up with that rule.
Yeah, and that rule ended up helping tremendously, because we had to really take things out and only keep what was really good and really necessary to storytelling. And so David would do that first pass of cut, send it to me. I would say, "Oh, I really missed this," or, "Oh, I missed that," or, "Well, we don't need that."
Or better joke,
on occasion. And then it would go back and he would do some more work. Or missed characters, sometimes he would combine characters. We did, one of my favorites was the Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which I had no idea was such a fun evening. I'd only known the film and I didn't know the play, but David had this fantastic idea. If you looked at the original, it's a really sprawling script that's quite messy and really complicated and bounces back between locations and knowing that we had limited scenery, limited props, you were able to just focus, especially the first half of the play, put it all on a boat, essentially. And it, so that's what Encores does, and what that, of course, allows us to do is give us more time in the songs, more time to dance, more time to really do the entertaining.
I would also say that I haven't done Encores for a few years. I stopped at 33 of them just because I found I'd been doing it for too long. I am a firm believer in only doing what's fun. And, you know, and it's not fun anymore. It's not fun for anybody else either. But the great thing about encores in the old days, which is no longer true, but when we were doing Strike Up the Band, you read it around a table on Monday, and you had to have it up by Thursday, and you had really, what, 5 days. You had about 5 days to put up a show. But they've extended that now. The great thing about that is, it's just like the Manhattan Punchline principle. When you have 5 days to put up a show, you have to be good. And that means you have to go with your first idea, and your first idea has to be good. And so everybody is at the top of their game, because the actors are at the top of their game because they know they've got 5 days to try to make this good. And so the concentration in the room is fantastic, and the fun. The fun was just so much.
Other questions? Yes, over here.
Are you ever surprised by what audiences find funny?
Am I ever surprised by what audiences find funny? Absolutely. Actually, case in point is Venus and Fur. Venus and Fur was an odd play because I almost inevitably know by the time of first preview what I have in hand, you know, what this show is. With Venus and Fur, Walter Bobby and I had no idea how the audience was going to take to this play or take this play. And we were worried that people would laugh at it. We were worried that people would walk out. You know, we had all kinds of worries, which was not helped by the fact that at the dress rehearsal, John Lee Beatty, I don't know why he did this, but John Lee Beatty, the set designer, sat through the whole run-through, and he walked up to Walter and me, and he said, "I think you boys should be ashamed of yourselves." And we're like, what does that mean? And so I think he was just toying with our minds. But that was a show that had many more laughs than I ever expected it to, you know? And so that was part of the experience of it. That was a show that totally surprised me about laughter. So yes, that was, yes, yeah, somebody over here.
I was wondering what your thoughts on were. How do you, the sort of risk taking of those plays has almost become cliche now that everyone's done one of them. So I was wondering, as both director and playwright, how do you sort of instill kind of from an education standpoint almost? Like, how do you make people comfortable with risk taking? How do you make people love the risk taking and be less afraid to do it?
On the timing, Trotsky is a good example. Trotsky, it's a play in which it's a genius idea. It's a simple, straightforward idea. There's Trotsky, he's at his desk in Koya Khan, lights come up, and he has an axe in his head. And go. And invent. And so this is what you're talking about, risk. It's like a magical, unbelievable risk. And David's variations on the desk of Trotsky. So we have, and David has 7 of them. And so you have to go through each of them. And the risk is, of course, what is it? And if you read it, you can smell, as he described to you, the honeymooners in the play itself. What a great idea to have Trotsky and his wife be Ralph and Alice. Like, it's so unbelievable.
He even says, "Bang, zoom to the moon, Mrs. Trotsky."
Yeah, he does. And so, I believe that, I guess what you're asking though about risk is really for the performer, a young performer, is that what you?
I mean, for performers and actors and sort of everyone in the room. Like,
yeah, well, I mean, as a performer, the commitment to the, if you, the genius of the idea, right there, the kind of absurdity and brilliance at the same time, that should be a trigger to your inner life and to what you're going to do if you play that part. Oh, that's a great idea. Oh my God, to think that, to actually think that he could be talking. Because it's true, it's the story goes that he lived a little bit with this axe in his head.
That was the original idea. You know what I mean?
He lived a little bit. What did he say?
Yeah, that was how that play began. Variations on the Death of Trotsky began because I was reading the New York Times one morning over breakfast, and I was reading the story about Trotsky, and it mentioned, by the by, Trotsky was hit with a mountain climber's axe and lived 36 hours. And I thought, well, what do you do for 36 hours with a mountain climber's axe in your house? You know, do you, fast food is obviously in order. But again, that play was like one of those weird gifts that, as I say, kind of were dropped in my lap, because a friend called me up as I was reading this, and I said, he was an actor, and I said, did you see the story about Trotsky? And he started laughing about it and thinking all the variations on what could happen. And it just so happened that friend, Fred Sanders, was having a birthday. And so as a birthday gift, I wrote him this skit called Variations on the Death of Trotsky to remind him of our funny conversation that morning. And I gave it to him as a birthday gift, and he said, you know what? We should put this play up. And so they did it at the Manhattan Punchline. And he didn't direct that one, but that's how that play came to be. But you know, when you say risk, I love risk. You know, I firmly believe that if it's not new and if it's not risky, what is the point? If it's not in iambic pentameter and couplets, why do it? You know, and so I love to hand actors a little problem. You know, it's like, I wrote this play called The Universal Language, which is written in gibberish. It's like, how do you speak in gibberish? And, or how do you play a monkey who is talking about Hamlet? And so there are these little acting problems in there that are, I suppose, what you would call risk, but what I would call fun. And so actors see these little challenges, you know, and every one of those short plays has some risky challenge.
You were in the middle of previews, towards the end of previews, in on Lives of the Saints, a recent version of it 2 years ago at Primary Stages, and we were rehearsing a play called Enigma Variations, which is basically a woman goes to see a doctor, a psychiatrist, but next to her is, her name is Bibi, and next to her is her shadow or her doppelganger, Bibi. And then there's...
She's named Bibi Doppelganger.
and the doctor has his doppelganger, their gangler. And the actors, Carson was in this, Arnie Burton was in this, there's others that we've worked with over the years. And we knew that we weren't quite there yet with it. And David did a pretty significant change and rewrite that caused a lot of interesting complications for actors who were just about to open the play and feeling a lot of nerves and wondering why the playwright and director were suddenly foisting these changes on them. And it wasn't easy to put them in because this language play was a poem and also a rhythm thing, and it's hard to remember. So we were busting our ass in rehearsal for a couple of hours, and at one point, we could both sense that it was getting really, really good. We could see that it was getting sharper and smarter and kind of just musical and really interesting, even better than it had already been. And David turned to me and said, you know, John, if it were easy, I wouldn't want to do it. And I think that's a real clue to his work. It's never going to be easy, but that's not the point. Why do it? You know.
Yes. In your head, do you see certain, in terms of casting, do you think of certain characters, certain people when you're writing for cast certain characters? And also following up, do you ever have a point of view when you're talking to a director who you'd like to see in the role?
Do I think of certain people and do I ask for certain people? Yes, there is a. Especially, I would say, with the French plays that I've been doing, part because, you know, when you write plays in rhymed couplets and iambic pentameter that are classically based, The acting pool you're talking about is about 12 people in the city, and six of them are not available. And so you have to, or when we're putting those plays up, and Michael Kahn has directed all four of the ones that I have in couplets, there is this group of repertory actors that has sort of conglomerated around those plays. And so by the time I was writing the third and fourth one, I was writing for Carson Elrod, I was writing for Amelia Pedlow or Tony Roach. There are these actors who just know how to do it. And we had to audition for, when we were doing The Liar at Classic Stage here this past year, we had to audition for one part of a young woman. And we went through days and days and days of young women coming in, and they were good actors, but it's possible they weren't funny. It's possible they couldn't do verse. And so if they can't do both of those things and be right for the character, you know, you're reducing and reducing. And then Ismania Mendez walked in, and she opened her mouth, and she had it. You know, she had it in one 10-syllable line. You could just tell she was that character, she was funny, and she spoke verse beautifully. And so, yes, I do, especially with those plays. And then, you know, auditioning is, these days, is often a matter of asking people you know, because you know that they would be right. Wouldn't you say?
I mean, for David's plays, it's pretty clear right away in the audition process that an actor walks in, and a very talented actor, and they just either get it, get the language, get the use of language, or they don't. And it's so clear, it's almost remarkable, actually. Other playwrights, other works, they aren't as interesting with language as David can be. And so that skill is not required. So when you walk into the room, for auditioning for a David Ives play, your language skill has to be way up there.
Do you work on lots of plays at once? You're clearly very prolific, and some plays suddenly, you know, come one morning when you talk with an actor, but do you often work on more than one at once?
I have, actually, at certain times, partly because there were deadlines, and sometimes I have had to, but I don't mind working on two things. But I can't work in the afternoon, but somehow that's always the dead time for me. And so I can work in the morning on one project, and then take my walk, think about what I did, take some notes, have supper, say hello to my beautiful wife, and then go back to work. I don't do that as much anymore, just because I don't have that kind of energy I used to, but I've been working recently on a few things at the same time. It's like I just finished a new play at the same time that I had to rewrite a movie for some producers. And so the question is, how do you apportion your time? And so I would work on a play in the morning because that's the blast, and then at night take a nap, wake up, and then work on the movie. So I don't mind that. Yeah, it is possible, but there are people who won't. It's like Stephen Sondheim says that he will not work on two songs at the same time, and much less two different projects. And so that's a totally different kind of, you know, everybody is really different. Anybody? Yes, ma'am.
I'm just amazed that you could translate the Corneille, and, you know, I mean, because that French too is not contemporary French. So how was it possible that you were able to do that with just a French grammar 3 weeks
with how was I able to translate these French plays?
It's incredible.
But, and she's asking about Corneille especially, but, you know, interesting question in terms of language, because it's actually easier to read 17th century French comedy than it is to read Yasmina Reza. Here's why. Is that in French classical comedy, the vocabulary was actually very limited. And once you learn the equivalent of fire, desire, moon, spoon, you know, you're well ahead of the game. But also, it's like, if you look at Racine, who, you know, great French tragedian of 1660, let's say, the vocabulary of all of Racine's plays is 3,000 words, which is not much. Shakespeare used a vocabulary of 27,000 words. And so that tells you everything right there, that once you, I learned all those 3,000 words, basically. And so it's not really quite as demanding. You know, there are little grammar things, but the French language has not, the French Academy was set up to freeze the French language, and effectively it has, so that the French language has not significantly changed in grammar in 350 years, which may be why Raymond Queneau, who's a great 20th century French writer, called French the Latin of the 20th century, because it is so locked in, you know. So that's really how. But you can't forget that when I go to these plays, if you look at Corneille's play, look at my play, I would say that Corneille represents 35% of what's on the page, you know, and not even literally, because what I find in translating these plays is this, and I discovered it very early on, that only playwrights should translate plays, because the first job of translating a play is actually not translating the language. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, even though a play is made of words, the words are the least important part of a play. I know that sounds like a paradox, and it is. Here's why. Because when you are translating a play, it is not, what you are translating is the current of emotion that is running underneath it. And what you need to do is you need to think as a playwright. You need to think, what was Corneille trying to get off his chest? What are these characters about? Who are they? What are they run by? And when you know that, then you find a way into the character. It's not, and then the language will come of itself, because then you allow the character to produce the language, not you. And here's an example. You know, a character in French says, oui. Fine. You can write down yes and move on. But depending on who that character is in English, that character can say yes, yeah, uh-huh, sure, right. The character cannot say anything and nod his head, depending on who that character is. And so that's why I say that's why it takes 3 months to think about these plays, because I am thinking about what is happening underneath the play. When you translate what's going on underneath it, the language will then suit that. It's not like you translate, it's not like a one-to-one correspondence, because then you get those professorial translations in which people are speaking academies, which is the death of theater. And so what I am doing with these plays is making a play suggested by that plot and those characters and running with it. And so I don't need to translate word for word, because that's not what I'm doing, you know.
No.
Richard Wilbur and I, in a funny way, are exact opposites. You know, he was a great translator, and when you read his Molière, you are reading what Molière wrote, but that's just not what I do. So, anyway,
we should probably wrap. Last question over here, one more.
What was it like interacting with Mark Twain?
You know, he was a son of a bitch. You know, really, the cigars, you know, the white suit, the pretension, it's really terrible. And he wanted the money. It was really bad. It was fun. That show was fun. Thank you all.
Copies of all of the timing for sale. I hear get one signed. Get two signed.
Yeah. Thank you.